So frequently in our culture, you hear somebody say, well, that's just a myth, right? Quote, just a myth means it's a lie. It's something that is somehow inherently not true. And I understand from what you've been telling me that you see that myth does include something that we understand to be truth. There's some kind of a truth that's being communicated. Another thing that my students usually give me right off the top, which you didn't, is it explains something we don't understand. Instead, I got something that I think is much more sophisticated here. The myth tells how things are, which is different from saying explains something we don't understand. Why do birds fly? Things like that, which then you get into the problem of how myths have to be reshaped as scientific knowledge expands and grows. So it sounds like you're beyond that issue too. We don't have to fight that battle. Let me just throw up the word that goes with that one though. Do you know this one, this word? That myths are often, I'm a Greek teacher, so I do, I have to put some Greek up. Myths are often etiological. They're giving you the cause for something, okay? That's one category that we talk about when we talk about myth. I cannot give you a one-sentence definition. I haven't come up with one yet, but you have listed the things that I consider inherently important when you think about what a myth is, or what myth is, which is a slightly different matter. It's a story. The word in Greek means story. Okay, so it's not just a description of some character, for instance. A goddess is not a myth. All right, it's a story. It's got a plot of some sort. In several places, we talked about the kind of language that's used in myth. That it's a symbolic language. In my field, allegory has not been invented yet either, but it's a parallel kind of language to what we would think of as the mundane world, the everyday, the workaday world. It's something that's not the usual kind of prose language that we all speak. It has something very important to do with community. Here it comes up. Here it comes up. The way things are can also refer to community. It's something that is traditional. It's something that's retold over and over and over again and shaped by the community. So it's a story that everyone who is a member of a certain group recognizes. You might even argue in many cases that it defines the group. It's not only shared by the group, but it also defines the group. In some sense. Certainly that's obviously true of the great foundation myths, they call them, how Aeneas founded Rome. That's sort of your classic foundation myth. I think you got everything else that I wanted to say on this.
Wouldn't we have to add religious faith or identity?
I was just about to put up here that I wouldn't use the word religious because that's also a loaded term, but that it has to do with
faith,
the heroic or the divine dimension. Okay, there are certainly myths that don't have anything to do with faith. Among my pagans, my favorite people, but they're. But it's elevated. It's on a scale that's somewhere above the normal. They're not quite like us. They're somebody that we're reaching towards. This is an important dimension to it that I hope to get back to in a minute.
What about the festive and ritual dimension?
Okay. Which would be part of this thing, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, ritual. Thank you. Not to get into a major dimension of the study of myth, but there's one whole school of thought that says that myth derived from ritual rather than ritual deriving from myth. And I would say, as expert as I might be, that it's a circular kind of process that myth and ritual kind of roll along together all the time. I hope to give you some examples of that in a minute. I also think, and this is another sort of loaded term, that in some sense, myths are classic. And when I say classic, I don't mean they are always Greek and Latin, but that they are, in some sense, a way of telling a certain kind of story that has evolved to the point where it really does it. You know, this one really tells that story, at least for that culture. So that, for instance, if you're going to talk about loyalty between a husband and wife, in Greek culture, you talk about Odysseus and Penelope on the one hand, and you talk about Agamemnon and Clytemnestra on the other hand. And Odysseus and Penelope, you all remember from high school, were totally faithful to each other given the double standard of the time. Penelope waited for Odysseus to come home after 20 years from the Trojan War and his wanderings. And that is the epitome of the good wife. And then on the other extreme, as Homer himself presents it right in the Odyssey, is Clytemnestra, who, while her husband Agamemnon was off in Troy, shacked up with another man, and when Agamemnon came home, she killed him while he was standing over his dinner like an ox over a trough. That's one way it's told. That's the other extreme. And other wives killed other husbands, and other wives were faithful to other husbands, but they always have to refer to these two great myths in Greek culture. So they're classic in that sense. The word truth came up, and I'd just like to throw another word in next to it, wherever it went here, that somehow the story is significant. I'm thinking back to what you said earlier about symbolism, when I use the word significant, that it points towards something, that it's not only itself. Okay, it's a sign. It's pointing towards something greater. I'd like to tell you three stories, just to give us something to work with. I think that at least one of them, maybe two of them, will be familiar. I'm wondering if I should leave that up. We'll see how long we can do without a bare board there. Story one. Once upon a time, there was a king and a queen, and the king heard from an oracle that the son that he was about to engender would grow up to kill him. And so when the son was born, he and his wife took the son and exposed him on a hillside, which was the Greek way of getting rid of unwanted children. Instead of the son dying, he was rescued by a herdsman and taken off to another country where he grew up and came back not knowing anything about mom and dad, and happened to encounter an old man along the way who made it difficult for him to pass by, blocked the road. They got into a fight. He killed the old man, continued on, came to the city where the wife was living. The city was plagued by an evil sphinx who wouldn't let people pass. The sphinx asked a riddle, so the man went and answered the riddle, killed the sphinx, came back, won the queen, saved the city, and later discovered that he had in fact married his mother and killed his father, thus fulfilling the prophecy that the old man had originally gotten. Is there anybody who doesn't recognize that story? That was the nutshell version. Most of you are familiar with it through the version that Sophocles tells, where he gets real interested in the problem of fate and knowing your destiny before you do it. The bear myth doesn't have that piece of it in there. Oedipus doesn't know his fate beforehand. I live in a town, story two, I live in a town where every year we have a big festival in September. Maybe your town has a festival too. A lot of them do about that time of year. At our festival, we celebrate the heroic exploits of one man who died while he was defending his trust, and the heroism of the townsfolk. What happened was that on September 7th, I think, 1876, Jesse James, Frank James, Cole Younger, Jim Younger, Bob Younger, Clell Miller, I can usually do this, Stiles and Charlie Pitts, rode into town and came from, I can tell you the whole story, but I'll condense, rode into town and attempted to rob the bank. This is Northfield, Minnesota. They came into the bank, some of them came into the bank, and sitting at the cashier's desk was a man named Joseph Lee Haywood, and they demanded that he open the safe, and Haywood said, "No, I can't." And they eventually shot Haywood and killed him, but by this time there was so much of a ruckus in the street that they were frightened and they ran out. And the loyal townsmen saw what was happening, and the one quoted quote from this whole event was, "Grab your guns, boys, they're robbing the bank." And they ran to the hardware store and got the guns off the rack and came out, and they had rifles, and the guys on the horses just had six shooters, and the guys with the rifles wiped out the guys on the horses, and Jesse and his brother got away, but the rest of them were nailed. Some of them killed and some of them sent to the prison. This is a community myth in Northfield, Minnesota. We reenact it every year. Not only do they reenact it, but you stand there on the sidewalk while they tell the whole story, and then they act it out while they tell the story again. Because it only takes 3 minutes to go through the whole thing. But as someone pointed out, it happens in the context of a festival. It's part of our ritual. Story 3. My grandfather, Frederick Joseph Benthe, was the son of a German immigrant, a Prussian immigrant, who had come to the Midwest. And my grandpa Benthe was the third son, the first son, oldest son of 11 children. And because there wasn't very much money in the family and it was a huge family to take care of, he had to quit school at sixth grade. And he went on to get a job for the American Lady Corset Company and do very well, and eventually sent his only daughter to college, where she got a master's degree. And then she sent her two daughters to college, and our family has been upwardly mobile ever since. Does that myth sound familiar? That's just, you know, a little family story. Do any of you have a family story like that? Can you tell your version quickly?
My grandfather was one of 17 children, and three of the children had died in 1 year in Sweden. And an older brother had come to the United States and had settled out in Seattle. And so Grandpa, as a 12-year-old, came to this country and traveled across Brazil and eventually homesteaded and had three sons, two of whom graduated from college, and everyone else, you know, it's the same kind of story.
A lot of us have that story somehow, I think. It's a story that we hear over and over in the family. I just told the three stories sort of back to back, but I'd like to ask you now what functions you see these stories fulfilling. We have obviously three different types of stories. One is a fairly personal story, a family. We're still talking about a group. We're talking about something that's shared, it's retold, it's traditional, but it's a very small group that maintains that story. And then the second one I told is a story of a larger group, a community, a town in this case. And the first one is, you know, a classic myth that was told and retold so many times that it became the possession not only of its own speaking, Greek-speaking culture, but even of Western culture, okay? We can argue, I think, how well it even works for us, but there it is. So I'd like to ask you about the functions these stories perform. What are they doing? So this is, I guess Aristotle was more into this, you know, not just what is it, but what does it do now? How does it function? How do these specific stories that I told function?
They give identity.
How? How do you see that happening?
Well, it's relating to this, kind of telling you what's things that have happened, though, where there's history up there, that's one, but not necessarily are detailed.
Okay, good. How does the Northfield story give identity, for instance? Somebody's back there, yeah. Who are you?
Back in the room before, we ran out of chairs. It gives a sense of shared history. All the people in the community are starting from that same point in time. They say, oh, yeah, that happened back. We can all talk about that. It gives us something to talk about.
And what's the message in that shared history?
You're all coming up to you.
Yeah, somebody said it. It's heroic. Let me tell you an epilogue to my Northfield story. About 10 years ago, some dope came to Northfield to try to rob the bank. And he was a dope because he did it. He successfully robbed the same bank that Jesse and his brother had tried to rob. And got into his car and charged up Highway 3, which is a two-way highway, but this was in February, I think, and the highway was snowy. I think chief of police happened to be standing on the sidewalk at the time, saw this happen, commandeered a car, which happened to be driven by a friend of his, jumped into the car, and they raced off after this guy, who, not too far north of Northfield, had gone into the ditch. And so it was a humiliating way to end this escapade. But what do you suppose it said on the headlines of the Northfield paper that week? Foolish robber thinks that he can foil Northfield. Right? And that man, remember the man that got killed in front of the teller's window, Joseph Lee Haywood? I mean, he was nobody. But he's got the biggest grave, the biggest monument in the graveyard. And every year at the beginning of the story, they say this year's reenactment of the bank raid is sacred to the memory of Joseph Lee Haywood, who, faithful to his trust, refused to open the safe to bank robbers. Esto fideles usque ad mortem, you know. And we have plaques for him in two places because he also happened to be the treasurer of my college. So in the business office, there's another one. Heroic. And it's making a very little thing something great and grand, and it gives us an identity as a community of people who are sort of tough, and they're not going to get by us, and we'll go to the hardware store and get our guns and take care of these guys, even though we're not trained law enforcers.
Isn't there a movie about a Great Northwest train robbery in Northfield, too?
The Great Northfield, Minnesota Raid. It's been done a few times.
What's going on in Northfield?
No, it's only one bank robbery, but about four movies. Okay, here's one function, then. It's a shared history. It's giving a community an identity, and it's a heroic identity. It's something to keep reaching for as a community. What else? We've got Oedipus, we've got family stories, and we've got Jesse James.
The family story sure gives a direction of where things are going and where members can aspire to go. And it also is kind of the element of heroicism in it too.
Mm-hmm.
Bootstraps.
Mm-hmm.
To Carlton or something.
Right.
The
ultimate.
Right.
You can send your kid to Carlton. That's back to this values thing too. It's teaching values that somehow are understood to be at the heart of my family. your family.
Okay. Somehow the Northfield story does that too, thinking of Ron Vignette's Bible studies, but what that does to glorify the bank also is being protected by all of us.
What about what it does to glorify Jesse? Northfield went through a real hassle with this because it's referred to by everyone as Jesse James Days. It's a four-day celebration now. And every year they emphatically call it on the buttons and everything, Defeat of Jesse James Days. And the baker in town even makes defeat out of donut dough. It's a struggle, you know? Is it Jesse James Days or is it the defeat of Jesse James Days? What's going on with the Jesse James part of it?
Why isn't it
Folk hero?
Why isn't it what? Yeah, why isn't it Joseph Lee Haywood Day? I'd like to hook this up with what Nick was talking about this morning.
Yeah.
What's going on there?
Well, Jesse James was more interesting and active, and he went out and conquered. And the other guy, whatever his name was,
he was successful.
I should put him up here so he'll be immortalized for this group.
Well, it's one episode, and, you know, Jesse James has this whole myth about him. Northfield was, you know, he should have stuck to trains.
Right.
You know, in Missouri, there's that whole myth of the robbing from the rich to the poor Southern boy from the Civil War, and putting on by the damn Yankees, and it just added to the whole myth that's grown up around him.
So how would you say that we react to Jesse James?
We've made him a folk hero.
Uh-huh. How is then, if he's a folk hero from the past, Nick was talking this morning about Charlie Manson as a some kind of weird hero, mythic figure now. What are we doing with bad guys, mythically?
Well, it's kind of anti-heroic. I mean, it's kind of anti-establishment. Some of the, you know, he wins out. I mean, secretly, we all sort of admire that, I think.
Okay. There's an admiration for the bad guy there. So what are we doing
well,
through the myth?
Success.
How does the myth function? How does the myth function for us, do you think? What are we doing with this myth?
We're meeting some of our own needs to have good, bad, clearly defined.
Okay. And what do we do to the bad guy, generally? Jesse's kind of an exception in this. What happens to the bad guy in the myth, generally?
Gets his due reward.
Yeah, he gets wiped out. So it's kind of a way I would suggest, you know, again, this is the nutshell, but I would suggest that it's a way of sort of holding up some dark side of ourselves and letting it run around and have a good time and then killing it or confining it somehow, imprisoning it. So it's one thing that's happening now is giving an identity. Here's another thing that myth, that at least some of these stories are doing. Let's see, what shall we say? Maybe just giving voice to what? To scary stuff, to dark things, to realities that we somehow need to deal with, but maybe we don't want to talk about in polite society. Let's go back to Oedipus for a second. What's Oedipus about?
Incest.
Yeah. Do you know my students never can get that? Is that interesting? These are smart kids. I say, what's the story of Oedipus about? Well, he married his mother and killed his father. What's that about? Well, he married his mother and killed his father. You know what? Incest. It's a bad word. It's about incest. It's about killing your dad, too. And what did Freud say it was about? I'm not poo-pooing his notions on this at all. Where do we go with that now? It's about incest, and there's even a line in the play where Jocasta, his mother wife, says, "Don't worry about this old oracle that you heard, Oedipus. In their dreams, many men have slept with their mothers." What's going on here? What's the myth doing for the people who tell the story?
Dealing with unspoken fears, desires, or even
yeah. Freud argued that everybody is somehow nervous about killing the same-sex parent and marrying the opposite-sex parent. Okay.
And I didn't notice it before, but when you told the story, I kind of noticed that first the person when it was in his way and he killed him, and then the Sphinx presented an obstacle that he had to get over, and he got through that, and then he married his... So it was through getting through these obstacles that he killed his father and then married his mother. And maybe it's just like Freudian thing of your parents are in your way, kind of. You always want to overcome them.
Or your dad is in your way.
Yeah, your dad is in your way.
And what's...
Authority.
It's authority. You could bring in some... Well, think. Part of the story we also forget, I think, is what about Dad? What was his attitude about all this? Remember, his name was Laius. What was Laius up to?
Trying to kill his son.
Yeah.
Yeah, child abandonment and killing his also.
And why does he kill his son? Why does he think he's killing his son?
To get rid of the competition.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's a two-way thing, right? The father is threatened by the son, and the son is competing with the father. Now, I mean, this version has been told so many times, I think it may even be trite to us now. But there's some kind of truth in that, Freud argues, and I agree with, that it's something that's so unspeakable that we can only talk about it by telling a story and then wiping out the poor guy who does it. Everybody in the story gets wiped out, right? I mean, poor Oedipus ends up walking off stage with blood spurting from his eyes, and he says that he would have stopped up his ears too if he could have. You know, that he's a destroyed person, and Jocasta, his mother wife, is hanging from the ceiling. So it's a pretty gruesome story, and as we were saying before, it takes care of those nasty things that we have inside of us by bringing them out, putting them out on stage, allowing us to get really scared about them and get really into them. That's a great play. And then we kill them, get rid of them. We clean off the stage when it's all over. Greek tragedy, you know, didn't have any corpses left when it was all over.
Pardon me, but isn't that a modern interpretation? How do you know that that's the Greek interpretation of that? How can we get that far back and see that's the way the Greeks thought about it? Maybe it has to do something about their ideas about death and not being able to, you know, avoid those two.
That's a very good point. The myth people, the people who study myth, would say that the myth is about the kind of stuff that I was just talking about. Sophocles, when he wrote Oedipus Rex, Oedipus the King, was real interested in that destiny issue. And he wrote that version of the play to put center stage the question of what would happen if you already knew this was going to happen to you? You know, how would that fix this story? How would that change this story? He was also very interested in the question of being an accursed person, because he keeps coming back to this Oedipus myth over and over again and keeps reworking it. But in all this is a very good point, because in the stuff that I muck around with in Greek literature, it's all artistic. We don't have what you would call a raw myth. We have Oedipus according to Sophocles. We have Orestes according to Sophocles. We have Orestes according to Aeschylus. We have Orestes according to Euripides. And they are all grinding a certain axe, and they're not always the same axe. Oedipus, in some ways, is a difficult one to use. I used it because it's the most, I think, probably the most familiar myth for us, and also because it's got this juicy incest aspect. With some of the other myths that are told many, many times through Greek literature, it's a bit easier to look at, let's say, six different versions and pull out what the myth is, as opposed to the artistic representation of the myth. So that's always a tension in it. You could even, I'm sure, pull the same kind of analysis out of the story about Northfield and Jesse James. You know, what's the raw myth there, and Where does the fact that Northfield makes a lot of money off of Jesse James Days come in? How does that affect the way the story is being told? I would submit that that's why it's called Jesse James Days and not Joseph Lee Haywood Day, right? There's always going to be the tension between art and whatever the raw story can be, which, I mean, in a way, I'm talking about something that's totally impossible, because the story is embedded in language, and as soon as you're talking about language, you're talking about artistic organization, formulation. So, yes, thank you for that. We've got two functions up there, is there? Any other thoughts about what they're doing? Scary, bad, bringing up scary stuff.
Isn't it also talking about violating taboos?
Okay, would that be a subset of that, wouldn't it? Violating taboos. Certainly the Greek examples I gave of the story of Clytemnestra and Agamemnon and the Oedipus story are about violating taboos. And this would have to do with the teaching of the values as a way of building society and defining society, self-definition. We don't do that sort of thing in our family. Very soon after that, the authorities seized him, and he didn't seem to offer any resistance at all. And pretty soon he was dead. And it was very confusing. This was the person that they had so much hope for. He was going to do it for them. And for some reason, those people who were his friends continued to get together. And they continued to break bread together and have these meals together. And their experience of him among them was so transforming that some of them said they had seen him after he was dead. And because their lives were so transformed by that, the rest of the community believed them. There was something magnetic about what had happened. What kind of functions does that story perform? What are the functions of that myth?
It's security. When someone that you're really close to, and someone who kind of reflects some of the heroic and divine things, dies, you've still got them with you.
It could give them hope to go on, couldn't it?
Where's the hope coming from?
The person.
He died.
But he's there in some of their minds. They're still with him.
Okay.
There's a connection with them. Participation in the meal.
And explains how the group is connected too.
So it's community defining.
Mm-hmm.
It would seem to tie in with what you said about ritual earlier, in that it explains things that your group is doing today that don't fit in the social context of today's environment.
Okay. So that it's an explanation. There's an explanation to it as well.
Huh? It's empowering. Effects show in the lives of the community.
How does the story give that power?
That's a mystery.
Yeah?
It brings the people together in the reenactment of the important aspects of that story, and by reenacting it, it reaffirms them in that and allows them to carry on and develop those qualities in themselves.
So the reenactment, it there's something crucially important about the fact that the community doesn't just tell a story, it does the story, in a sense. Is there any extension of that? The community, and that the example I gave is the community coming together to eat. Is there any other way in which the community is acting out the story, is living the story?
The church in reality?
I'm sorry.
The church here.
Okay.
Reminds us of the story.
Okay. Sort of picks the story apart week by week and lives it through in a long, to a long version.
Well, they try to live like he lived.
Okay.
They tell the story and invite others to make it their story too.
Okay. So there's a this dimension. I'm sorry, he's up there now. The shared history that's heroic, giving identity, is also providing, I didn't get it up there, I guess, is also providing that value to reach for in identifying with the story and identifying with the main character in the story, so to speak.
Well, it's about death and life. It's about hunger and satisfaction. And, it survives because there's truth there. I suppose all myths survive because there is truth there.
So it's doing these other things. It's a high level, and it's communicating truth, some kind of truth that transcends facts. It's significant. It points beyond just the story itself. How do you see that myth to be relevant to this community right here? Now we're a microcosm of that community that tells that story.
It's our shared identity.
You think everybody in this community would tell a story exactly the same way? Would everybody tell it the way I just did?
No.
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, I thought for a while about how I was going to tell the story. So, you know, this gets back to your point in a way. We all recognize that story, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we might say, well, you know, she left out this, or there's this other version, or... There's an underlying story that is an agreed upon story that may not even be something that anybody could tell in one line, and we've got four Gospels to make it confusing for us that way. It's a story that has many different versions, but we all recognize it as one story. The different versions are each trying to make a different point, say.
Well, it has to do with a hope that couldn't be killed. I mean, the hope goes on.
Okay. Yeah, the life and death aspect of it, I think, is extremely important. And I think that the great myths are all about those kinds of things. Life, death, birth, relations between people. We haven't actually talked about gods much, but, you know, there's a divine dimension to modern myth that makes it somehow more important. It's about something that is ultimately real, whatever that may be. What do you see to be the myths of this community, or the myth of this community?
I think this community, maybe any other one, occurs to me. What makes this story unique is that, and this may not sound terribly Lutheran.
It's okay, I'm not a Lutheran.
I know. I think it's not you. But there's an option to alter the story, too.
I'm sorry?
To alter the story, too. In the sense that the story can be carried on to other cultures and people, but also in the sense that you know, as you told the story, this Christ was rejected, but there, Matthew 25 says there's another opportunity to mm-hmm. change that story and to love Christ and the neighbor, mm-hmm. the person who's needy or vulnerable in some way. Mm-hmm. I think that's part of what keeps the story alive, too.
Now, see if you can just erase all this Christian stuff from your minds for a second. We have a minute left, really. And let me ask the same question again, but don't start from where we just were. What are the myths of Holden Village? What are the stories? What are the stories that bind this place together as a community back there?
And eating lower on the food chain.
Very low.
Is that a story? Is there some way that that becomes a story of this community?
It's reenacted every week.
So it's part of the ritual version of myths.
It's a semi-heroic convention.
What other stories do you hear?
Oh, that we're coming up here to rejuvenate and go out into the world, spreading the word that we've learned here.
I think the founding of the community is a story that is, and Wes is a sort of cultural icon.
So there's a foundation myth.
Yeah. Foundation myth.
Okay. Yeah. And there's I think this, what Rebecca was just referring to, is a real interesting dimension to it. Can you boil down the story of the visitor to Holden Village? Is there a story that everybody can tell? Unsuspecting Episcopalian arrives in Lucerne. And what's supposed to happen? What's the story? You guys aren't cynical enough, are you? I'm not laughing at this, really. You come to Holden Village and you have some kind of a transforming experience. Mm-hmm. You find serenity. Mountaintop? Mm-hmm. Mountaintop
is a place apart.
Right. Uh-huh.
You've and come through the waters.
You part the waters. Come up on the mountain and then you receive something and you go back down the mountain. And what happens after you go back down the mountain? Ideally,
a new person.
And what? Then who do you become? Aren't you then a messenger of some sort? I mean, is there not a myth of like that alive here, alive and well? And doesn't it function to bind the community together and give it identity, hold out a hope, teach a value?
Because when you meet somebody else who's been to Holden, there are just certain things you automatically talk about.
Uh-huh. And you can see it in their face, right? Before you right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, as I said, I wanted to give you some structure to think about myth. I wanted to give you some sort of resources, I hope, so that you will be able to find myth in things like what we were just doing, and it is kind of trivial, but not really. I laugh about Jesse James, but that is the real thing in that community, and I've used this example many times, and it's always funny, but that town is defined by that story, and your town probably has a story, too, that's very much like that, maybe the foundation myth of the place. But I just hope that as a result you'll be a little bit more attuned to the story and things and thinking about how the story is functioning rather than worrying about whether it's true or not in a sort of mundane, factual way. We have time for some questions.
There are a lot of other myths, though, that attach to North.
The one about St. Olaf?
Well, whatever. But I don't think that should be the sole definition for that community.
It's not the only definition, but it is the one that's reenacted over and over again. Yeah, there's also the little sign that you pass on the way into town that says, Welcome to Northfield, a special place.
Or the City of Cows, College is in Contention.
Right, but they don't put that on the sign. Do you have any questions or comments? We've got about 5 minutes before. I don't want to walk through this next. They've got a movie going on in there or something. Yeah.
One interesting aspect of the Holden and the similar places of but not to the idea that, that getting closer to nature, you get closer to God. I recognize that aspect of it.
And that's part of the story. Yeah. The mountaintop experience is a literal mountaintop experience here. And
yes, and it's the trees and the rest of it.
And then there's the story of the original miners in this town. And the little town that they lived in, the story of the houses that they built. There's wonderful stories around that.
I'm sure we could allegorize all of this too if we wanted to work at it.
Oh, and to develop the whole myth further, maybe it's because I participated in this, but I think a very common topic of conversation is the perils one had to go through to get to the edge of the water, which is all part of, you know, a myth, a common part of myths, but it is a very common table conversation.
Yeah, and one thing I didn't even touch was the, I mean, how many of you know about Joseph Campbell? Have you been watching him on TV? I mean, I stole his title, right? The classic heroic journey, we haven't really touched, but, you know, you have to fend off dragons, you have to jump over abysses, you have to walk through fire, all the rest of that stuff, and it can all be interpreted through psychological symbols. But, so that's another whole dimension of myth that we just didn't touch tonight. But certainly we could apply it to Holland.
Yeah. But this is a gathering of the chosen, the special people. They're nice people. You leave your doors unlocked and all kinds of things can take place up here that can't happen elsewhere.
Well, this would be the underworld experience in the classic heroic journey, I think, that you cross the seas and whatever. We'd cross the Indian reservation to get here, the bleak, barren wasteland. And then you descend. I mean, it's the opposite of the mountaintop, but you descend and somehow discover the truth there. If you are, while you're here, engaged in a lot of reflection and self-questioning and that kind of thing, which I gather many people get into while they're here, that kind of getting in touch with God stuff, that becomes the underworld experience. You know, you may get in touch with things about yourself that frighten you. You may see monsters there, but while you're there, you meet the goddess, or you meet Mother sometimes, or you meet that important divine figure who shows you the way to go back up. So, you know, that's another version of the story.
It'd be interesting for people to share quickly what their communities hold up by way of the same Northfield days. Doris and I come from Thousand Oaks, which is kind of the epitome of the fastest growing suburb with silicon all over the place, and yet when we have Kaneo Valley days, we all eat chili and dress up like cowboys.
Yeah. Makes you think.
Yeah.
First, I'll tell you, I live about 45 miles from Northfield, but will you just, in the shortest sentence as possible, tell me what a myth is?
Myth is a story, a traditional story, told and retold by a community of importance that transmits a sense of the truth in a language that is artistic and poetic and, what would you say, elevated? What did I leave out?
It's very good.
Thank you.
And it's telling something important. Maybe I said that. It's important. I have one teeny comment that I can't resist making. Most of these myths, these really heroic myths, don't work very well for women. And it's particularly, I'm very clear about that in my own discipline as a classicist, that they are men's stories. And one of the things that I'm getting more and more interested in, and some of you maybe can tell me about, is the place of fairy tale as a dimension of this, because it seems to me that the fairy tales are the women's versions of the myth. Mm-hmm. And they're minimized. I mean, in heroic myth, everybody's got a name. You know what country they come from, what town they come from, where they've been, their history and everything. In fairy tales, you have a king, a queen, a princess, and maybe one person with a name. But even sometimes their names are real stupid, like Sleeping Beauty. But you know, you think about what are the feminine versions of these things in the traditional stories. I'm not talking about, you know, our own family stories or whatever, but frequently, I mean, you think about the classic Grimm's fairy tales, the story generally is that the girl, the beauty, does something that results in her being rescued by a prince.
She has to be beautiful.
Oh, there's some awful stuff about it. Yeah, she has to be beautiful. She's usually the youngest, which always irritated me. Mm-hmm. She's usually blonde, too.
Small feet irritated me.
But I would just leave that with you to think about how well do these heroic stories work for women.
Oh, and are there cultures?
Yes.
Another thing I just thought of from that about the purpose of myth is I've heard lots of people say that like Odyssey and stuff like that, a lot of the purpose was to kind of defend patriarchy and like the order of the sexes too, how women were supposed to support society in stuff.
The stories give order to what's already there. Yeah, I think that's true. They're conservative. Myths are conservative things. They're not usually offering you something that's different from what you already know. It's better than what you already know, maybe, or it's a bigger version of it. But it's not usually trying to shake up the foundations of the community, because it is something that helps to shape the community as it is. That's a good point. Yeah.
Would a myth be either real or an imaginary, either one then, would you say?
I think myths are always true in some fundamental sense. It may not be that the story happened to real people, but there's some kind of fundamental truth to them. Are they done in there?
Yeah, I think
we've got to go. Yeah. Right.
Thank you.